You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Not too bad, all things considered.
That's all a person can ask for when a person is at Harvard these days, which you are, which is part of what we're going to talk about. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Stephen Walt, and you are a professor at Harvard, as I suggested, which is good, because we're going to be talking about Trump's, I think you could call it war on Harvard, maybe, and his war more broadly on certain aspects of higher education, I guess you could say. You, more specifically, you are the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School. You're also the author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy, a not entirely flattering look at the U.S. foreign policy establishment. If people are curious about that, there's actually a conversation between you and me about it on YouTube that they can search for. Probably your best-known book is The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, co-authored with John Mearsheimer. Now, when I ask you, and I'm not going to ask you this yet, but when I ask you whether this book has any relevance at all to Harvard, to Trump's kind of conflict with Harvard, I suspect you'll say it has at least some relevance, but let's leave people in suspense for now. And why don't we, for now, just ask you to give us some sense of the magnitude and scope of what Trump is trying to do to Harvard, leaving aside the question of whether it will ultimately be validated in the courts. There are a couple of things that have gotten the most publicity, but I don't even know whether they exhaust the whole subject. So what's the biggest stuff from your point of view?
Well, I think the way to understand it is this is an attempt to get Harvard University to in a sense, surrender its independence as an intellectual institution, as a university devoted to free and rigorous inquiry on a wide variety of subjects, from the natural sciences to the social sciences to the humanities. And if you look at the demands that the administration has directed at Harvard, they basically would involve Harvard surrendering enormous control over how it does its operations, how it hires its faculty, how it admits its students. They want audits of departments, of programs, probably course materials, things like that. And we can get into this in more detail, but this is sort of straight out of the standard autocrat's playbook of what you do when you're trying to consolidate executive authority in a country. One of the things you have to do is go after the independent sources of thought and criticism, and universities are foremost among those. And because Harvard is the wealthiest and most prominent American university, if you could get Harvard to surrender and, basically bend the knee, then you can assume that lots of other institutions would follow suit. So I think this has to be understood as the administration's attempt to basically, if not completely take over higher education, bring it under its control. And then in order to do that, they've launched a wide-ranging assault on lots of different institutions at Harvard and lots of the support and bases of, revenues for the institution in an attempt to pressure it to essentially do what the administration is demanding.
Okay. Now, I guess you're referring mainly to the withdrawal of funding, which is pretty huge. There are $2.6 billion, I think, of federal funds that Trump would like to withhold from Harvard. There are smaller amounts that other universities are threatened with losing. I think the biggest of those may be Johns Hopkins, which is $800 million or something. Columbia would be hit hard if it didn't do business with him, which it seems more inclined to do than Harvard is. And I guess this all kind of, now I should say separately, there's a couple of more recent things. There's the ban on admitting international students, which is specifically directed at Harvard. And then most recently, something that pertains to students of Chinese origin broadly, of Chinese nationality, which we could also talk about. In the case of Harvard, I guess that's kind of redundant because they're not supposed to have any international students at all from Trump's point of view. So did the, as far as the withholding of funding goes, $2.8 billion is a lot of money. I mean, I guess it is most or all of the federal grants that Harvard receives. I mean, first of all, is that about right?
Actually, it underestimates it because there's some other additional sources of federal support that Harvard has gotten that aren't part of that $2.2 billion. There's, you know, $60 million worth of contracts that, you know, for other services Harvard was going to provide. There's about $1 billion that would go through Harvard to various research partners, other institutions that are working with scientists and researchers at Harvard in various places. So the actual number that's affected is even larger than that. And of course, to do that, you have to sort of go around and find every part of Harvard that might be getting some federal money. Most of that's in areas of like biomedical research, things like that, the Harvard School of Public Health, the Harvard Medical School, things of that nature, some of the hospitals in the Boston area. Mm-hmm. And again, that conveys the degree to which this is really an assault on the entire institution. They're not right. asking whether or not this is worthwhile research, whether this research is being squandered. They're simply trying to inflict as much pain as possible on the right. institution by going after every source of direct federal support. But that's not all. So going after foreign students, you know, isn't about keeping America pure or preventing espionage or anything like that. It goes directly at the revenue basis of the university. Most foreign students aren't on scholarship. They pay full freight. So, for example, at the Kennedy School of Government, where I teach, 57% of our students are from overseas. Mm-hmm. And that means if you suddenly say, well, none of those people can come to Harvard anymore, that's a direct hit to the bottom line of the school. The administration has also threatened to, revoke Harvard's tax exempt status, which immediately means you have to pay taxes on your endowment income. It means that people who want to give money to Harvard, you know, loyal alumni, things like that, could no longer write it off as a tax deduction. So it'll decrease the number of contributions you get from alumni as well. Again, this has to be thought of as a full-blown assault on the university. And of course, other universities are suffering similar pressures as well. And the purpose, of course, is to make an example of Harvard so that everyone else will be so fearful of this kind of treatment that they won't do a single thing that the administration doesn't like.
Okay, so I guess a big kind of moment in all of this was when the administration issued a letter with a bunch of demands made of Harvard. At that point, Harvard seemed in principle willing to negotiate, but finally concluded, I guess, that the demands were just too extreme to even negotiate about. I mean, let me read a little bit from the letter, because this is part that speaks to the question of what I think you could call, you know, ideological control of everything in the university. So it says, by August 2025, the university shall commission an external party which shall satisfy the federal government as to its competence and good faith. In other words, the federal government gets to decide what body is doing this monitoring. Okay, and it goes on about what this body's going to do to audit the student body, faculty, staff, and leadership for viewpoint diversity, such that each department, field, or teaching unit must be individually viewpoint diverse. And of course, they define viewpoint diversity. I would think that alone would almost be a deal breaker for a serious university, because that is just saying we are going to, you know, any kind of part of scholarship that seems to have an ideological dimension, we will decide what the appropriate ideology is, right?
Right. And that's, of course, infinitely elastic. You could extend that into any realm of the university. You could say that we've looked at your biochemistry department and we've looked at your medical school, and we don't think they have enough vaccine skeptics on the faculty. So we need to have some people here who actively think life-saving vaccines are dangerous, because after all, that's what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Has been arguing. So there's no end to the amount of pressure or the amount of demands you could make there. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I was not, I'm not part of the central administration at Harvard, but I think it's clear that they were going to enormous lengths to try and negotiate in good faith with the administration. And this letter, when combined with the way some other universities had been treated, such as Columbia University, which tried to accommodate the administration and just got a new set of demands in response, the combination of that letter and some of the prior experiences made the decision to reject the demands, I think, a relatively easy one for the president and for the central administration, for the Harvard Corporation. And it's worth noting that that rejection has been immensely popular within the Harvard community and I think within higher education, that someone had finally stood up to the bullies.
Yeah. Now, I guess Harvard is particularly vulnerable to this kind of thing because of the kind of work it does and the amount of federal funding for that kind of work. I mean, especially for a prominent university like Harvard. I gather Columbia is in its own way pretty vulnerable. Somebody from the Princeton faculty was explaining to me that Princeton's, partly because it doesn't have professional schools, it's not as vulnerable. It also has a very big endowment, not as big as Harvard's, but as big on a per student basis, probably. But what this person said is that like if Columbia had just right away said no way, you know, like things would have stopped happening in hospitals in New York and you know, people would have died and things like that. Whereas other schools aren't so vulnerable, but Harvard, of course, has all of these, first of all, you know, huge, big scientific and engineering programs that get a lot of funding, but also all the professional schools, including a lot of involvement in the health system around there, I'm sure. So, I mean, does that, and then, of course, is the fact that Harvard is kind of the alpha university in terms of prestige. So I guess it's the perfect target in all those ways. It is, right? It's like, it's what I'd choose if I had authoritarian aspirations and were a president.
Yeah, no, people in the United States, have an ambivalent view of Harvard. It's sort of admired as this remarkable educational institution. It also attracts a certain amount of derision or envy or anger, even people who think that Harvard is, somehow a bastion of a bunch of Maoists who hate America. Nothing could be further from the truth. But in that sense, I think for people in MAGA land, it's easy to dislike Harvard. It's easy to be resentful. If you ever had a relative who applied and didn't get admitted, that's another reason not to like Harvard as well. Harvard is not unique, of course, in its reliance upon federal support. I mean, the federal government's role in American science, technology, and higher education goes back really to World War II and the immediate post-war period when the U.S. government recognized that it had these various islands of extraordinary scientific and academic achievement, and therefore one of the ways to make the United States richer, more powerful, more influential, was to support these various institutions, and along with, of course, federal labs and other private sector operations as well. And this has been extraordinarily successful over the last 60, 70 years, no matter what metric you want to use, whether it's, number of Nobel Prize won by American scientists, whether you want to talk about number of patents, the fact that the United States has been the technological leader in a whole series of domains. And I might add also has been by far the most influential and important source of growing knowledge in the social sciences as well. Higher education is not perfect, and there's always, ways you could improve it. But cutting it off at the knees is, I think, an extraordinary act of self-harm, which will be realized upon subsequent generations.
Yeah, I think you're right to note that there are Americans who probably don't have an especially high opinion of Harvard, or what they think of as just elite, coastal elites generally. And it was very smart of Trump to recently say he wants to take money from Harvard, I think he said, and give it to vocational schools, right?
Right.
And if he wants to fund vocational schools, there are other ways to do that. He can tax rich people, for example. but it's better politics probably to say you're taking it from Harvard. Now I assume you wouldn't deny that, you know, they complain about, you mentioned, you know, Marxism. You said nothing could be further from the truth than that Harvard is full of America-hating Marxists. There are ideological tenors that prevail to some extent in academic departments, right? Now, it seems to me the clearest examples are actually with disciplines that are arguably not as consequential as other disciplines. I mean, I'm thinking like anthropology, I think of as at a number of universities being pretty lefty these days. Political science, less so on balance, I would guess, and so on. But in any event, the one of their grievances, which is that that academic departments at elite schools are not always exactly representative of some, you know, idealized diversity of opinion on subjects. There's some truth to that observation, right?
I think that American academia at present, probably leans left, doesn't lean very far left, except for sort of isolated pockets in various places. But it hardly means that conservative voices are absent. They're, you know, prominent conservatives at Harvard, you know, people like the late Sam Huntington, you know, very much thought of as a conservative figure, Harvey Mansfield. Over at the law school, my friend Jack Goldsmith, you know, was an attorney in the second Bush administration as well. There are a number of other prominent conservatives as well. The Kennedy School, where I teach, has had people who served in Democratic administrations, people who served in Republican administrations as well. And we're very pleased by that. We've had a long and very positive relationship with different parts of the American military and the American intelligence community. As well. So the idea that at Harvard is, a place where a bunch of people sit around, smoke dope and criticize America is, I think, again, a sort of right wing talking point. One thing, you know, that I think is legitimate is that in response to a number of recent events of the last 10 years or so, one could argue that universities like other parts of American society swung a little too far in a progressive direction, that there were some litmus tests being put on. This is what people complain about when they talk about excessive wokeness. And we've now been seeing, even before Trump was reelected, the pendulum swinging back in a variety of ways. One sign of that was was Harvard's decision to do something it had not previously done, which is to adopt a formal statement on institutional neutrality. Not dissimilar to the famous University of Chicago Calvin Report from the 1960s, which basically says that the university does not take as an institution an official position on political and social issues, except for those that directly affect the functioning of the university, like the issues we're talking about right now. But it doesn't take a position on the death penalty. It doesn't take a position on whether or not we should attack Iran. It doesn't take a position on any number of questions as an institution. Individual faculty can and do take a variety of positions. Students are welcome, consistent with academic freedom, to take whatever positions and then to argue about it amongst themselves and with others outside the university. But the president, the deans, the institution, the Harvard Corporation is not going to issue political statements on issues, certainly not be partisan and certainly not take positions. Harvard had never issued that kind of a statement, and we did so a year or so ago, I think in recognition that the university had to be an arena where lots of different ideas contended as freely as possible, but the university did not try to represent either the president's preferences or the corporation's preferences or some a collective assessment of where the faculty and students were. That was not its job.
Yeah, I think that's probably a healthy change. It does seem that over the last few decades, there had been growing pressure on institutions, not only colleges probably, and in a way prominent people to like take positions on big controversial issues. And maybe we're better off if a lot of people just choose to remain silent, except on things they feel that they have a direct stake in or know a whole lot about.
Yeah, or just have a strong opinion about it, but they do that as individuals. So if, you know, a colleague of mine from the biology department wants to weigh in on voting rights in America and what's being done to them, they're free to do that. You can discount what they have to say because they're a biologist. They may not have studied the issue all that closely. I can weigh in on vaccines, but nobody should take my opinion all that seriously because I'm not trained in that area. Universities are communities where individual scholars can say what they want and should be encouraged to do so and supported when they do, and then held to high standards. So, you know, the other thing that makes academia work well is the fact that we hold each other to account, that, you know, fraudulent research is punished, mistakes get detected by other scholars. And so there's a big incentive to try and be as accurate as possible and to speak only from a position of expertise, but you don't want either the president of the university or the president of the country telling people at universities what to think or what to say or what to write.
Yeah, I think the idea had been implicitly, we didn't talk about it a lot, but that, there are different departments, you know, at different universities will have a prevailing ideological tenor maybe, but on balance, the country's just better off having a decentralized approach to that, where different universities do what they will, then have the federal government monitor them all and tell them what they should say and think, which really is pretty close to what Trump is asking for, it seems.
Right.
Like.
And of course, this, you know, assuming we retain a two-party system and a lively and vigorous democracy, you know, does people who support what Trump is doing into Harvard, would they like a equally radical Democrat to call up Claremont and say, we've noticed that you have some academics in some of your departments and programs who seem to have some pretty extreme views. We're going to cut off all support for Claremont until you fix this situation. This is the road that dictatorships go down, and it's never good for their intellectual communities. It's never good for their societies as a whole.
Yeah. And it does seem, I mean, this is just one dimension of kind of the authoritarian playbook. And he seems fairly active on some of the other dimensions. I mean, you know, there's this business of suing media organizations. ABC caved and paid $15 million or something, which I guess nominally goes to the Trump Library, plus a lot of money to him for legal fees. CBS, I guess Paramount is in the process of caving over the CBS thing. Meta coughed up $25 million. And then Amazon, you know, paid what, 20 or 25 million to Melania for documentary rights or something. I mean, I suspect, you know, if you want to really a documentary that would do well in the marketplace, it would be one she didn't approve of probably. So I'm not sure about the logic of paying her for to participate in the thing. But, you know, so there's that. And, you know, that isn't just like so it's not just a media thing. Like Paramount makes movies, right? And they recognize that if they want approval for some merger or something, they've got to suck up to Trump. But they also own CBS. Bezos, you know, he's got Amazon Prime Video, which was the conduit for the money, but he owns the Washington Post. And we've seen, you know, the opinion editor resign over what Bezos wanted to do with that, David Shipley. So, you know, you've got like kind of culture, you know, whether high end like the Kennedy Center, where Trump's obviously meddled with, or middle brow like Paramount or low brow, whatever you want to call it. You got the media, you've got academia. I mean, what are the other primary institutions? I mean, there are other parts of the authoritarian playbook, but what else do you go after? And is he going after them too?
Well, yeah, law firms. Right? Yeah. So you take some of the biggest, most prominent law firms, and you're mad at them because they did their jobs when you were president in the first term. They may have helped some of the people that the administration was going after in mm-hmm. the past. And so Trump has decided to punish them. It has not worked out particularly well for the law firms that caved first. You know, they didn't. The demands upon them didn't end. They kept going back and trying to ask for more from them. But also some of their partners began to leave, and it hurt their reputations. Right. Does anybody mm-hmm. want to hire a law firm that's that easy to intimidate as well? But again, it's all part of the same thing. It's not just universities. It's the attempt to go after any independent sources of expertise, thought, independent judgment within the society. And again, that's, I think, pretty standard. Two of my colleagues, Steve Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, who, of course, wrote the book literally on how democracies die, pointed out recently in an op-ed that what's happening here is an attempt to increase the costs of dissent, of disagreement, of opposition, make it costly. You're not throwing people in jail necessarily for disagreeing with you. You're just going to make it expensive. And the whole purpose, of course, is to deter people, to make them realize they're just better off. You know, nice life you've got there. It'd be horrible if something were to happen to it. And we can go after your funding. We can attack you in various ways. We can maybe incite some people in MAGA to send you a lot of rude emails and make you nervous as well. And so far, the administration has been doing that in a whole series of sectors, as you suggested. And, you know, people have occasionally likened Trump to a mob boss, and the method is kind of similar. You know, if you do what I want, good things will happen to you. If you don't do what I want, then something bad might happen. Bringing it back to higher education, this was perfectly expressed by, you know, Secretary McMahon, the Secretary of the Education Department, where she said a couple of weeks ago, you know, university research should be in sync with President Trump's goals. Right. And if that's not a clear statement, is that we don't want independent research, we don't want academic freedom, we don't want to follow the rule book that has made the United States, the scientific and technological leader of the world. We want everyone to be in line with our agenda. And if not, we'll make you pay.
Mm-hmm. So is Harvard at the moment, has much of this is tied up in the courts. Has that insulated Harvard from the immediate impact?
I don't know in full detail. I think it remains to be seen. I think different parts of Harvard are going to be affected to different in different ways. So some parts that are very dependent on federal research support are going to have to, cut budgets, lay off people. There have been some truly tragic stories about what's happening in parts of the scientific community at Harvard, where, you know, people who had ongoing research programs that were, you know, highly successful, highly promising, have had to shut them down, and they can't just be restarted. There's a famous story that has circulated around campuses of a biologist who had, you know, something like 100,000 white mice and was busy euthanizing these white mm-hmm. mice because he could not afford the staff to maintain them. The problem was is these mice are genetically compatible over time. They've been genetically bred so that you get reliable results as you use them in biological research. And once they're gone, you don't have that line of mice any longer. You can't rebuild it overnight mm-hmm. as well. And you could multiply stories like that, you know, we're shutting down research enterprises that will take years to rebuild. If the scientists are still in the United States, if they haven't gone to other countries where they're more welcome. Again, that's what I mean by a sort of long-term self-harm.
Yeah. And, you know, I wonder whether some of this, if certain aspects of it were highlighted differently, might cause Trump more political trouble. I mean, there are a lot of people who do not want to see progress on cancer research slowed, for example. Right. Low-income people, high-income people, black, white, and so on. But you don't see the direct connection because it isn't quite direct. I mean, it takes research a while to play out. But look, if you just got diagnosed with cancer, it may be that you've got a few years and then you need a breakthrough. And Trump is cutting funding now for things that could lead to that breakthrough. You would think that might cause him some political trouble, but I guess it hasn't been publicized much quite that way.
Well, and again, I think the effects are only beginning to be felt. Some of those are more long-term, you know, research results. But for example, in the hospitals that are connected to Harvard Medical School, there are lots of faculty there who are partly researchers. They have grants of various kinds to do research in their specialties, but they're also clinical physicians who are also treating patients, sometimes as part of their research, sometimes just as normal clinicians. Of course, when you take away vast, you know, billions of dollars of research funding, some of those doctors are not going to be available at Harvard Medical School, which means that patients who are expecting to get care will get their care. They'll just get it more slowly. It'll cost more. It'll be, and that's the kind of thing that people will begin to feel. I think that's probably pales in comparison to what the cuts to Medicaid are likely to do. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of thing that ordinary people, I think, are gonna feel. I just wanted to add one other thing, right? The easiest thing for universities to do is try and defend this kind of thing, you know, cancer research. Don't you want to support that? But I'd also make the argument that it's very good for and very healthy for the society to have lots of different voices at lots of different universities investigating social and political questions, whether it's, you know, voter turnout, public opinion, business cycles, doing research on, you know, economics and what works and what doesn't when you're trying to bring back, say, you know, communities that, you know, have fallen on hard times as well. And you want a wide range of people doing that research. Mm-hmm. You want people like me who've been critical of American foreign policy under Republicans and Democrats, but you want me, you know, down the hall from someone who thinks everything the Bush administration did was mostly great, mm-hmm. right? And let us argue in print and in person about those things and have students get exposed to those different points of view. If you don't have that, if you have a president and his team that basically wants to impose their beliefs on everybody, mm-hmm. right? Then who's going to tell them when they're making a mistake? Who's going to let them know that there might be some alternatives that would work better? You know, when countries are basically following the ideological preferences of a single leader and their like-minded, you know, cohort, they make huge mistakes. And that's, you know, sort of the history of Stalinist Russia and Nazi Germany and other dictatorships. One of the great virtues of democracy is that we can argue and debate different policy alternatives. We will make mistakes, but we're more likely to identify them, and we're more likely to come up with new approaches and new solutions. And to abandon that, it seems to me, is an enormous social science experiment that's not likely to work out well.
Yeah. I guess the political impetus for some of this goes back a few years when you started hearing the uproar about, you know, woke culture and deplatforming conservatives and so on. I'm wondering how prominent a phenomenon was that from where you stood? Was there a lot of at Harvard? Was there a lot of deplatforming of conservatives or harassment of conservatives, or they're just not getting invited to speak in the first place, or?
Yeah, there was some of that. And it was, as I indicated a while back, I think the pendulum swung too far in the other direction. Mm-hmm. It was, I think, understandable. In some respects, it was a reaction to, you know, revelations, whether it was the Me Too moment and frustration with the status of women at universities. Certainly the sort of structural impediments to minorities gaining a foothold in the academic world. And so there were real efforts being made at Harvard and lots of other places to try and make higher education more representative of the society as a whole. Now, there were cases where I think conservatives got deplatformed, but of course, there are lots of cases where non-conservatives have been deplatformed over the years if somebody in the local community or someone on a faculty didn't want them to speak there. I don't think there was a systematic bias against conservative voices especially, you know, appearing on campuses. Certainly at the Kennedy School, we have had plenty of people who I would consider pretty far right of center addressing students, teaching classes, being senior fellows, you know, guest lecturers of one kind or another, and in some cases, members, full members of the faculty.
Mm-hmm. You know, one dimension of this I didn't mention, probably should, is students who are immigrants, in some cases even green card holders, have been, you know, subjected to some pretty bad treatment. I mean, the most vivid example is that Turkish graduate student. She was on a Fulbright at Tufts, I think, and there was the video of her being, you know, abducted on basically in the street by masked people who were not obviously law enforcement authorities. Pretty creepy. Those are, you know, I'm talking about people, cases where the problem seemed to be things they had said about political issues, largely about Israel-Palestine, you know, which brings us to the question of what, I mean, I guess I think of a couple of issues as being most prominently mentioned by Trump and his people to justify this. One is DEI, their war on DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, you know, kind of affirmative action, whatever. And the other is what they're calling anti-Semitism, which is what they invoked in the kind of case I'm talking about with this graduate student. And first of all, do you think I'm right? Like, is that are those the two prongs, your two kinds of justifications you're hearing most from the administration, or am I missing a third?
No, I think that's exactly right. And certainly the efforts that have been made to, you know, weed out any kind of research that has the word diverse in it, or, you know, the word inclusion, anything connected with race, for example. This is just part of the whole, I think, ideological apparatus surrounding the Trump administration. So that's been part. And the second element has been, you know, in the wake of Gaza in particular, the accusation directed at universities, Harvard in particular, but not only Harvard, that they had somehow become hotbeds of anti-Semitism. And this is, you know, repeated over and over again, including by, of course, an administration that has made common cause with real anti-Semites on numerous occasions. So in some respects, I think it's being used and exploited for instrumental purposes. Now, my own view, of course, is that it's also been grossly exaggerated as a problem at American universities, including Harvard. Harvard is, in my experience, a remarkably philo-Semitic institution in almost every way. You know, as people have pointed out, I think three or of the last four presidents were either Jewish or, you know, in the case of Drew Faust, I think married to a Jewish man. Four of the nine deans at Harvard currently are Jewish. I don't know what the percentage on the faculty is, and I wouldn't ask, but it is substantial as well. I have been there for 25 plus years. I have never heard anyone say something that I would regard as even remotely anti-Semitic, even in the sort of genteel form that Harvard many decades ago, you know, pre-World War II, et cetera, is, I think, genuinely guilty of. In the wake of the Gaza war, there were some, I think, you know, unfair, ugly incidents, some of it, you know, sort of stupid undergraduate behavior. This famous letter that was signed by 30 student organizations, which essentially pinned the blame for the original Hamas attack entirely on Israel, which was at a minimum insensitive and at a maximum just plain wrong. And so there were moments, I think, that of concern. But the idea that Harvard had suddenly become an unwelcome place for either Jewish faculty or Jewish students, again, has been grossly exaggerated. And if I were to criticize the administration of the university, is I don't think they did an effective job of pushing back sufficiently as the charge, in part because some members of the Harvard faculty, some alumni, were very quick to magnify the charge. And I think there was a case of people trying to essentially defend, go after the people who were criticizing Israel's response to Hamas's attack in Gaza as a way of defending Israel. And in that sense, Harvard has become collateral damage of the sort of long Israeli-Palestinian struggle and, you know, the fact that it has never yet been resolved.
Yeah, and this predates Trump, of course. There were the famous congressional hearings with three college presidents. I guess it was Penn, Columbia, and Harvard, doing a not great job of conveying. I guess they came off not looking all that great. They had been, I think, they had been advised by lawyers to stick to a particular script or something, but they, I guess it was Representative Stefanik who made them look pretty bad. A couple wound up having to resign as a result. And so that's, of course, that was after October 7th and a result of it. And at that point, I had in mind, I mean, to what extent was donor pressure? Now, Bill Ackman was a very conspicuous figure there, right? He's this billionaire, I guess, Harvard alum and donor who's staunchly pro-Israel and also staunchly anti-woke and I guess some of the other things Trump would want a person to be. But how much at that point would you say, Harvard's, well, I guess at that point they were failing to push back as vocally as you would have liked. I forget whether they made substantive concessions. Well, I guess firing a president is kind of a concession, come to think of it.
Yeah, although that was not, I think, the resignation of President Gay was not driven primarily by that issue. That was back in the background. That was clearly a problem. I think the final straw there was the discovery.
Plagiarism.
Yeah, the academic irregularities or plagiarism.
Yeah, but as you say, it was the final straw. It was only against the backdrop of the pre-existing pressure that even came out.
Right.
I guess, you know, I guess the truth is a university president who has clearly committed plagiarism should probably go in any event. But as it played out, it did come off as more the last straw coming, you know, just when people like Bill Ackman were hoping something like that would come.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think there's no question that pressure from prominent donors, you know, always gets the attention of university management. They pay close attention to keeping, you know, donors happy. And that was operating here. Where the university, I think, erred was not making a much more rigorous defense of the basic idea that within a university community, you're going to have lots of different views. There's some views that, you know, you want to insist on people being open. You want to insist on people being civil. Students should not be, you know, attacked, should not be intimidated or threatened. And if that happens, there are disciplinary procedures that universities can and should follow as well. My impression, and I can't claim deep knowledge here, my impression is that much of this was not at places like the Kennedy School, which is a graduate school, of older, somewhat more mature students, where you had people on all sides of the issue as well, but a relatively civil environment. Most of the problem existed in the undergraduate population within the undergraduate houses, where, again, you had people who were very passionate in what they believed and what was in reacting to it, and also had to live together in dorms, had to eat meals together. And that created a rather tense environment, as any major conflict might. And that was being managed by the resident deans and others, I think, reasonably successfully, not perfectly. But again, to go from that to the claim that these are institutions that are unwelcoming to Jews, that are hotbeds of anti-Semitism, was to me an enormous leap. And of course, it also is based very much on an extremely broad notion of what constitutes genuine anti-Semitism. So, you know, the chant, if a student group was chanting "from the river to the sea," this was seen as an anti-Semitic remark, which I don't think it even comes close to. That same phrase has been part of the Likud party's platform in Israel, for example. So it's hard to regard that as evidence of anti-Semitism. And final point I'd make here is that I don't think the Trump administration really cares very much about this. It's just another club that they can use to beat universities over the head. And therefore, you know, I think it's obviously a issue that all universities should be mindful of, the same way they are mindful of any form of prejudice, because that's contrary to the ethos of a university, where all people should be welcome to exchange ideas and be who they are. But again, it's something the best handled by universities, and not certainly by trying to cut them off at the knees.
Yeah. I think that phrase from the river to the sea, if you ask all the students uttering it what they meant by it, you'd get a diversity of answers. I'm sure you'd find that some of them would qualify as anti-Semitic. I suspect it wouldn't be anywhere near a majority. For that matter, I suspect if you ask everybody in Likud who supported putting the phrase from the river to the sea into the charter, you'd hear at least a few things that sounded pretty horrendous in justifying it. But I also do think that there are some Jewish students who find the phrase, who feel threatened by the phrase. And it's a very complicated situation, because I think, as you say, I think what most students mean by that, and I've been pretty involved in this because my daughters go to these, you know, they went to these demonstrations, they have friends. Most of the friends who went to the demonstrations with them were Jewish. And I've talked to some of them about what all this means. And it is complicated. But of course, lately there have been truly horrendous incidents, a couple of attacks, one in Denver and one in Washington, D.C., as we tape this. Anyway, I want to talk more about all this stuff. As you know, what we generally do when we tape these is we do about half of it in public. That's this part. And then we have what we call overtime, which is available to paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. You've agreed very kindly to stick around a little more and talk about this, so we'll keep talking about it. But first, before we go into overtime, Steve, I wanted to give you a chance to do any summing up, or for that matter, any self-promotion. If there's anything you've done lately, any writing you want to call attention to, or any place people can find your writing, or
The most regular place to find my writing, of course, is my column on Foreign Policy Magazine. Mm-hmm. The most recent column being on the importance of global rules. Odd position for a card-carrying realist like me to be.
Not if you were a progressive realist, Steve.
Well, maybe you're
becoming one.
Realists are often accused of not believing in norms, institutions, and rules, and this is a false charge. And in fact, realist scholars going back decades have always emphasized that they're important.
Hans Morgenthau, Parts of Politics Among Nations, sound like they were written by the most woolly-minded one-worlder. He says someday, depending on how technology plays out, world government can make sense. He says that. Right? You know,
he actually was more outspoken than that on that. Even argued that the development of nuclear weapons, in fact, created the imperative for establishing a world government, or eventually we'd all kill each other with nuclear weapons. So Murenthau is one example, but there are plenty of others. And you know, even my friend and you know, really arch realist John Mearsheimer has written several articles, the most recent of which on institutions emphasizes that in an interdependent world, you have to have a set of norms, rules, and institutions to manage relations, and that they are tools that states use to advance their interests, but can't live without.
I'm glad to hear that. I have some issues with John's views on China. And in fact, that's on YouTube, too. Me and John Mearsheimer arguing about that. But maybe I'll take that up in overtime as well. We'll get into this whole issue of realism. And I do want to talk about China, actually. So we'll talk a little more about the Harvard thing and the fine line between fighting anti-Semitism and suppressing criticism of Israel. And then maybe we'll move on to some geopolitical stuff in another realm. Anyway, thanks everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you will follow us into overtime. There's a link in the show notes that can turn you into a member of the Non-Zero community almost immediately. And we'll see folks there.